honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross. But if you had him as a high school teacher, he probably wasn't talking about that or the 56 missions he flew in B-26s with the 731st Bomb Squadron during the Korean War. 97-year-old Bob Otto of Bakersfield, California, has preserved a lot of his records and paperwork from his time in the Air Force. I see a lot of missions, and all it says next to it is classified, classified, classified. I mean, it's been almost 70 years. That stuff has to be declassified by now, right?
Possibly so, but my Form 5 shows that every mission that I went on was classified. So be it.
And why was that? What was so sensitive about what you were doing that classification was necessary?
I'll use one example. That is, one evening or one night, I'll call it, about close to midnight, while we were looking for targets, and there's nothing moving. The navigator bombardier puts us on a course towards the Russian border. The navigator has just announced that it's about time we turned around, and when we start our turnaround, why, the whole sky lights up. And so I presume it's the Russians with their radar, and they have an unidentified on their sights, so they're let loose with it. Of course, we were never hit by any of it.
So just to make sure I understand you correctly, and sorry for all the questions. So the need for classification was, this is in a sense a proxy war. The U.S. is not at war with the USSR, but you're there engaging Soviet forces. And if that were actually taking place or known to have taken place, that would create a whole lot of issues for a whole lot of people.
Yes, that's the reason the navigator would not let you get too close, and he would tell you to do a 180, which you did, and get out of the area.
So there aren't any secrets you've been keeping for 70 years that you feel like sharing right now?
No, I have no secrets to give out at this time. I don't know.
Well, I know you do have a story of a pretty significant close call, and I'm sure that wasn't the only one in 56 missions. Maybe I should ask that. How frequent of an occurrence was it that, as you targeted enemy forces on the ground, there was return fire headed for your B-26?
Quite often. In fact, as I stated before, as soon as you cross the bomb line, why, anything that moves becomes a target, and you're a target. I recall on one especially, we had strafed a marshaling yard. In so doing, we got lots of return fire, and we had a 20-millimeter go through our left wing and went through one of our own ammo boxes, 50 caliber boxes, where the hole where it went into the wing, so forth, it took out about a foot square area. I recall seeing an area inside of the wing that was burning, and I couldn't understand what in the world, what's causing the fire in there. So anytime you're hit, you're required to land at the nearest friendly field. So, of course, we had to land at the nearest friendly field, and we got on the wing with a flashlight and looked in there. And what had happened was the 20-millimeter had gone through one of our own 50-caliber boxes, and it had broken the casing on a couple of rounds, and that was the powder falling out of the casing and burning in the wing. So we could have had a dangerous situation there, but we were very fortunate.
So what were those moments like on your plane among your crew as you're sitting in that right seat looking past your first pilot, and beyond him in that left wing is this glow that just won't stop?
It's kind of hairy.
Was there a discussion of perhaps bailing out?
Oh, no. I don't think we would bail out unless there were really something explosive taking place and so forth. No, as I said, any time you were hit, you had to land at the nearest friendly field and assess your damage. And we'd had that probably two or three different times.
So that's not the only close call you experienced?
No. We were hit a few times. Very fortunate.
What's the closest you think anything came to you personally?
Probably closest would be a hit in the wing, so forth.
Well, and you said, and maybe it was an understatement, you said that could have been a dangerous situation on your hands there. In each of those wings, as you told us earlier, you have .350 caliber machine guns in each wing and ammunition in those wings as well that are feeding those guns. And that's what this enemy bullet hit. It's burning the powder that leaked out of one of those shells. But, I mean, what's your guess? If that were to happen 50 times exactly the way it did, how many of those times would it actually work out the way it worked out for you?
It's hard to say. Each hit is different. And we were just very fortunate.
And you were just talking about the work you did, that one of the things that would make your missions more successful, and when you would spot those planes and you guys would unload on them, that you could set off secondary explosions because of what they were carrying. Couldn't that very well have happened in your wing there?
Trains, yes. But let's put it this way, it was exciting.
But, I mean, I'm not misunderstanding the physics of it, am I? I mean, that round from the enemy could have set off some of that ammunition in your wing and could have taken your wing off.
Oh, yes, it's very possible. As I say, we were very fortunate.
Yeah, and a couple sons and grandkids and great-grands that are thankful that that worked out the way it did. Anything else from your time in the Korean War that you look back on with particular satisfaction or fondness?
Nothing having to do with fondness, because war is, as everyone has said, war is hell. That's the way I felt about that one, but I was very fortunate.
And I've seen your medals. I saw the Air Medal with quite a few clusters representing multiple awards, and I also saw the Distinguished Flying Cross. And I've had a few guys tell me that they handed them out like candy, but I've learned that that was not true. You had to do something to deserve a DFC. So what's your understanding of why you're one of those people who can display that medal?
Well, the first pilot is the one that put me in for it, and I didn't even know I was going to get it. And actually, I was leaving the base. I'd finished my tour. I was leaving that base to become a radar operator as such. I ended up getting a DFC and five air medals.
Do you have an understanding of what you did that your first pilot put you in for it?
Yes, the article has to do with being close to some mountains on the right-hand side that he couldn't see, and he didn't want. And we were after a train, and he didn't want to get too close to them, so he asked me to take over, and I took over and was able to fly the aircraft away from the mountain area, line it up for him on his strafing mission on the train.
And that wasn't the only time you had to take over the controls. The other one I know about, I don't think the first pilot wanted you to take over the controls. You talked about your esteem and respect for Fields and what a luxury it was for you to be with a guy who had flown the same kind of aircraft in World War II. But later on, they rotated some other pilots through.
A couple of what I called desk jockeys. I lacked a few missions to get out, and so I flew with these two gentlemen, lieutenant colonels, and one was the navigator, bombardier, and the other was the first pilot, and I was second pilot. I had saw this train, and I said, there's a train out there at the time it was about 9 o'clock. They said, where, you know, and I finally said, well, let me put the nose on it. So I put the nose right on where the train was, and they still did not see that train. And the train at night, of course, there are no lights or anything like that. What it is a line of steam. You know there's a railroad track there, and you know that the steam is there, so it has to be a train. And as I say, they never saw that, but I had seen 9 of them prior to that with other pilots.
So you just finally had enough and said, I've got to take over here?
Yeah, I did. Well, actually, I had to reach over and activate the weaponry so that it would fire, and then reach across and pull the trigger on his yoke. The yoke is what you use to fly the aircraft with.
Did he ever say anything to you about that?
No comment whatsoever. Of course, he was a lieutenant colonel, and I was only a first lieutenant.
It's been so long since the Korean War, and many have called it the Forgotten War. Some have said it was an unfinished war because of the way it came to a stalemate. How do you see or understand the significance of what you and so many other Americans did over there during those years?
What a job that you were trained for, and carry it out. That's what we tried to do.
Well, you know, I've interviewed quite a few World War II vets who, especially if they were in the Navy and they're at sea for 3 or 4 years, and then they get home and they see a child who maybe they knew before the war or maybe was born while they were actually at sea. And, you know, obviously that kid isn't going to recognize him. But I understand it was a different member of the Otto family who didn't recognize you when you got back to the States?
Oh, the dog, yes. I'd flown into Sacramento, gotten on a bus to Bakersfield, and when I got out at the end of the bus, I got a cab at home. When I got out of the cab to go up to the back door, why, Cindy, our black Cocker Spaniel, did nothing but bark at me.
I'm guessing Etta recognized you, though.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But that was nice because we had a 30-day delay en route. Then we were able to drive back to Langley Air Force Base. Being as I was had been a teacher and so forth, I knew exactly what it was being. That was as a ground school instructor.
And that wouldn't be the only thing you'd teach. Back here in Bakersfield, you spent 3 decades in education, teaching history and geography and public speaking at East High School, home of the Blades. And I guess that eagle eye that helped you spot all those trains helped you with coaching a specific club there on campus too, huh?
Oh, yes. We had a rifle club there, and that's one that I really enjoyed because I was teaching marksmanship and safety for NRA, National Rifle Association, of which I'd been a member, life member for years. It was great teaching those youngsters safety and marksmanship. It had some great people in those classes.
And some of them may be listening right now. One of the radio stations that airs Hometown Heroes is in Bakersfield, KNZR. And I imagine you have a lot of former students listening. And there also have to be quite a few people listening whose lives have been touched by you in another way. We talked about your trumpet. But where did the idea come from for you to play taps at the memorial services of thousands, not tens, not hundreds, but thousands of deceased veterans over a 30-year period?
Greenland River, you might, Boulevard, they might have started it. They would ask me to, they would call and say, could you come to and do a veteran's funeral service, play taps for us? And so there might be one every couple of weeks or so when this first happened. And then, of course, as time went on, why the number of members of the service that we lost became greater and greater, and it wasn't long until it was almost a permanent thing. We started doing it at the National Cemetery also. Our 7216 VFW had a crew. We would do the veterans' military rites.
And anybody who's ever been at a service like that knows the power. But I don't know if I've ever thought about what it's like for the guy playing the taps. I know for those folks, every one of those families, to have a World War II and Korean War veteran playing taps for them meant so much. But over all of those, what did that mean to you, and why was it so important for you to be there and do that?
It comes from the heart. It's just something that you feel you have to do. I've done as many as 7 in one day at the National Cemetery.
I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you, and there's one more thing I've heard that I want to make sure is true. Did you really dodge the honor flight for years and years? They kept trying to talk you into going to Washington, D.C. with them, and you just wouldn't go?
Yes, because I felt like I would be depriving some other veteran of his flight to Washington, D.C. And then finally I decided that there was ample room for one more. So I took the flight and was very pleased to have done so, and thank all of those people that are involved in Honor Flight.
So with Honor Flight Kern County, you got to go to Washington, D.C. with your son John as your guardian and share that experience with them at the World War II Memorial and the Korean War Veterans Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial with 58,000 names on it. What did you get out of it? I know you waited a long time to do it, but I can tell you're glad you did finally do it. What did it mean to you?
Grabs your heart and makes you feel like something has taken place.
You know, another question came to mind for me when we were talking about the service you provided for so many veterans' families in their time of need when they're burying a loved one, and you were there to play taps, and even in tandem with another bugler, the echo taps, which adds another level of power and emotion to it. Have you ever thought about someday someone's going to play taps for you?
Absolutely. And at 97, it probably isn't too many days away, or years away at least.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story. Is there something that you think back on and you say, you know, that right there, that's what I'm most proud of or most satisfied with?
Yes, doing all of the services for our fellow veterans, playing the taps the thousands of times, and Battle Hymn of the Republic while they're folding the flag, and many times making the flag presentation to the next of kin. It's very touching.
Yeah, I can tell that. I mean, you wouldn't have done it as many times if you did, if you didn't see it as a great privilege and an honor to do that. You know, one thing I haven't asked you, as I've heard about some of these close calls and your crazy experiences, for everything you've made it through, and the fact that some of those other situations you saw others fall victim to, or that you came awfully close to suffering from yourself, how do you evaluate that? Is that sheer luck? Is that happenstance? Do you feel that you were protected somehow? What's your view on that?
Yes, I feel that I was protected. I don't know. It's just one of those things. It's way of life. You live it, and some are more fortunate than others.
And I guess I should ask you in closing, because you've been there for those final moments and the last honor that veterans receive, where families are making sense of it and they're grieving the loss of a loved one who served our country. When you think about those who have given that last measure of devotion, the 400,000 plus who died in World War II, more than 50,000 in the Korean War where you served, and close to 60,000 more in Vietnam, and those today, how should the rest of us who've never worn their uniform, how should we view those who have made that ultimate sacrifice?
Just witness and be cognizant of the fact that they served their country, that it was an honor for them to have served, and so forth. Just grabs you from the heart, so.
Bob Otto's dedication grabs me from the heart, and I'm guessing it might be the same feeling for you wherever you're listening right now. I mentioned you could find video online, and some of that is Bob playing his trumpet, but I think if I'm going to tell you about all the times that he's honored his fellow veterans by performing taps at their funerals, we ought to conclude with that very sound from a 97-year-old who just never stops giving. I'm sure you can already guess what Bob said when I put him on the spot before leaving his home and asked him to open his trumpet case and play taps for me. And that is how the program is going to come to an end today. I encourage you, as you listen to Bob play, imagine all those families and how they felt when he played taps for their loved ones. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.